This week's cloud disaster story is a shocking one from 2009, and one that really chapped my hide at the time. Today we dive into the turbulent history of Carbonite, a once prominent cloud backup vendor. From posting fake reviews on Amazon to a major data loss incident and a multi-million dollar lawsuit, Carbonite's story is a cautionary tale for both customers and vendors in the backup industry. Join me and my co-host as we uncover the details of Carbonite's missteps, including their use of woefully inadequate storage arrays, lack of data redundancy, and failure to take responsibility for a huge customer data loss. We'll also discuss the lessons we can take away from Carbonite's mistakes. One big discussion is guidance on what customers should look for when they're evaluating a cloud backup provider. You'll learn what happens when you blindly trust vendor marketing. And you will learn the importance of thorough due diligence when entrusting your data to a third party. If this is your first time listening, hi, I'm W. Curtis Preston, aka Mr. Backup. This podcast is my attempt to make sure that what happened to me 30 years ago will never happen to you. My employers lost their purchasing database and I couldn't restore it. I dedicated my career to making sure that that wouldn't ever again happen to me, and now I'm passing it on to you. We take unappreciated backup admins and turn them into cyber recovery heroes. This is the Backup Wrap-Up. Welcome to the show. Hi, I'm W. Curtis Preston, and I have with me a fellow possessor of useless knowledge, Prasanna Malayandi. How's it going, Prasanna?
I'm good, Curtis. Yeah, I do tend to have a lot of what I would consider random knowledge, not always useless. I know sometimes it's helped you.
Yeah, okay. You do have useless knowledge. You do also have useful knowledge. I've kidded you about it in time. I'll be doing something and I'll be like, working on the timing chain on my Prius, a car that you've never owned. And you're like, well, did you do the thing with the thing with the thing? And I'm like, how do you know this? And you're like, well, YouTube,
I watch a lot of YouTube.
But recently you and this person to which I am married have been kidding me a lot about my recent arguably useless knowledge.
I don't think it's recent, though. I think you've had this in your head for a while. And I've only discovered it recently that you have this random knowledge in your head.
So it's relatively recent, by the way. It's within the last year that I asked myself, what are the different kind of palm trees in California? And I found out that, first off, I found out that there's over 3,000 palm tree species in the world, and that there's something like 50 to 90 palm trees, depending on who you ask, that grow, here in California.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
Oh, that grow in
50
California.
50 to 90 that grow, period. There is only one species of palm tree that is native to California.
See, look at this. You're already correcting me, the expert, the palm
expert.
Yeah.
And that, but with all adding all of that up, if you can correctly identify roughly 5 species of palm trees, at least in Southern California where I live, you can cover 99% of the palm trees that you're going to see, right? And I point this out to people. I bring it up. That's the weird part, is that I bring it up. I'm like, hey, look, it's, and I did this with this lady that I was talking to. And I was like, oh man, they got a lot of king palms in this neighborhood. And she said, you know the different kind of palms?
Curtis and is I like said, my life mission is I'm ready. Like,
yes, I do. Would you like to know? And so I start sharing with this person the different kind of palms. And then she said, can you tell me the kind of palms that are in my yard? And I said, yes, I can. And for the record, she had a combination of queen palms and king palms. Queen palms are from South America. King palms are from Australia. And only the Mexican fan palm is native to California. And for those of you that have looked at California, been to California, the Mexican fan palms are the ones that grow like 150 feet tall, yeah. right? With the tiny little sprig of green on the top. They're also 20 feet tall, but they're the ones that grow to the really, really tall ones. So yeah.
Do you feel fulfilled?
You and my wife have been making fun of me and my possession of this random knowledge.
So are you sure that this woman was not paid to ask you this question?
No, she was not paid. I am pretty confident that she expressed genuine interest in the species of palm trees that were in her neighborhood.
No. Are you sure that she expressed genuine interest, or now that you're replaying the story in your head, you think she was expressing genuine interest?
I am convinced, sir, okay. And I stand by my story.
Okay, so now that you've finished palm trees, what comes next?
I don't know. It has to come upon me. It has to be. I need a muse. You know, I need to be inspired.
You know what inspired? I think last time when you did this, we used to walk all the time.
We did. That is what happened. We used to walk together separately. Walk together separately, right? On the phone, and I was realizing in my neighborhood the incredible diversity of palm trees. Now that I have this knowledge, I need to redo that walk and then see how many of them are actually, just of the five.
Yeah.
So anyway,
So listeners, if you are walking and you encounter a palm tree and you're on Twitter/X, post it there and tag Curtis and WC he will Preston. Respond. Yep.
Yeah, I will respond if it's one of the five that I know. it's kind of funny. What is funny is when I like if I'm trying to teach somebody the difference, for example, between a queen palm and a king palm, and they don't get it at first. And I'm like, it's so obvious. Like, look at those two trees. The difference between a king and a queen is so obvious. And it takes them a minute, and then they have the aha moment. And I feel it's like the moment when somebody brings up the 3-2-1 rule out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I say, yeah. So speaking of the 3-2-1 rule, so here's my question, Persona. We have been talking a lot about cloud outages and cloud disasters, and so far they've all been like a cloud provider that is supposed to do the thing, and in every one of the cases, if the customer had just had a backup, they would have been fine. So
yes,
right.
Except in the only thing I was wondering though is OVH
a proper backup.
Yes,
you know we rely on these backups a lot, and so today's story, you know, the story that went live yesterday really gets me upset, because in that story, the vendor lied to their customers.
Yep.
They said that, you know, it's proven in court that the vendor lied to their customers. They told them that the server was in a fit. At least one customer, we know that they specifically said, I want a server in another data center. And they said, you got it. And then it turns out that they didn't have it.
Because contracts and operations don't always align.
Right,
two separate people, right. Two separate orgs.
Yeah.
But,
you know, one of the things that we tell people to do is I'm a fan of cloud-based backup.
I never would have guessed.
I think it's a killer app for the cloud. I really do. Right.
Yeah.
Which is why this story bothers me so much. And that is that we have a story of a backup vendor that, you know, lost customer data.
Yep.
And it's so frustrating from the story, right?
Yeah.
So
Well, I would say that it's not even just lost customer data, but also the way that they've been operating isn't necessarily what you would look for in a company that you're trusting your data to.
Yeah, there are multiple incidents of, I'll call it everything from, you could call it lack of candor. You could, you know, depending on how you want to characterize it, some of it is outright, I don't know if I'm going to say lie to the degree that OVH did, because that was, you know, proven in court that they purposefully misrepresented. In this case, we do see them misrepresenting things, but, you know, do we know for a fact, has it been proven in a court that it was a lie? No, but the activities that we see happening weren't good. And so what are we talking about, Persona? what are we teasing?
So the company,
a big name, name, right? This is a name who, you know, say 4 or 5 years ago, you couldn't go to an airport without seeing this name. It was everywhere. Right, what are we talking about?
We are talking about the company called Carbonite. It was a large company that recently was acquired or merged and is now part of OpenText, which is a Canadian-based company.
Which is going to figure into the story.
So maybe we should roll back things and just go way back in time and talk
Let's go way back in time. So first, you know, I'm going to bring up a story that it's not on topic, but it's relevant. Okay. A couple of months before the key story that we're going to talk about happened, Carbonite got busted by essentially a part-time like internet sleuth, right? It's just some blogger guy. And what they got busted doing was posting fake reviews on Amazon, right? And this sleuth uncovered it. You know, he busted. I remember, you know, I wrote a blog post about it back when this happened. This was in, by the way, this was 2009. And this person found that that basically they had created a combination of like fake accounts and in some cases just really poorly disguised accounts. And all of the metadata pointed that that these reviews that have been these really positive reviews that have been posted on Amazon were in fact written by either Carbonite employees or by people related to Carbonite employees, right? And this guy uncovered it, and he blogged about it, and the New York Times covered it, a blog called Pokes Post. And by the way, this is one of the stories that it's a little difficult for us to cover because some of the things that we're referring to aren't all, they're not left. Like the original blog that started the investigation seems to be gone, right? I don't know if the entire blog is gone or just the blog post. Luckily, the New York Times article is still around that refers to this. But yeah, so they were posting, what I remember was that they tried to pass it off as nothing, and then they just sort of got busted doing this. And that story broke just a couple of months before the big story that we're going to talk about. Any thoughts about that?
Like, I just think back to like 2009.
Yeah.
This is in the days where like people weren't doing it all that much, right? Posting fake reviews, and you didn't have the smart algorithms to try to detect this. You didn't have all the sort of review farms or paid reviews and all those things happening like you do today. And so maybe they just thought, yeah, maybe we could just get away with this. And like, that was probably, they probably didn't think that there would be a risk of being caught, right?
Yeah. One of the people that was posting a review was the vice president of marketing at Carbonite, right? So that's sort of the timing under which this happened. What's that?
By the way, we're not saying it's bad to post reviews. It's there's nothing wrong with that, right? We're just saying it's bad to post reviews pretending to be other people trying to give an unbiased give an unbiased opinion.
Yeah, it is actually, you can get in trouble, like in the U.S., you can get in trouble with the SEC if you do that.
Which we'll talk about later.
Yeah. The SEC will resurface in the story. Okay, so here's what happened. 2009, a couple of months after that story, basically, it's interesting. So I'll tell it not, and this is sort of like Star Wars. I'm going to tell it in the order that it happened, not in the order that we found out about it, right? Because how we found out about it is beyond my comprehension. So what happened was that Carbonite had outsourced the backup part of their backup software to an IT vendor that then purchased disk drives from a company called Promise, and $3 million worth, by the way, $3 million worth of hardware from this vendor. They then had was it a dual disk failure? They had a dual disk failure in their RAID arrays. And as a result of that, they lost the backup data of 7,500 customers.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that 7,500 customers lost the data that they cared about. They lost the most recent backup. And then what they were able to do is they immediately restarted the backup.
Yeah.
And they're saying that what we now know is that 54 customers out of that 7,500, the data that they were backing up was damaged in some way. Their PC crashed or they deleted it or something. And then they went to go restore data and they were unable to do so because the data that they wanted to restore was in that data that was lost.
Yeah.
Which is, formerly working at a backup vendor, that number seemed high to me. The number of customers that would restore 54 out of 7,500, right? That's 0.1%.
Yes, but right, that's just customers who encountered another error before they could, because who knows how long it took them to back up, right? It might have taken them days depending on how much data they had, because they had to basically back up everything again.
Yeah, I guess I'm just saying that, knowing what I knew about our former employer, people just don't restore stuff. Yes. They just don't do a lot of restores.
Unless they needed to. Unless they needed to, though, right? And in these cases, So, and that's our hope, right? It's that they just hope that nothing bad will happen while everything is getting backed up again. And of course, it's for those 54 people, that should
happen. It's sort of like how you hope that another disk drive won't fail when you're only using RAID 5. You hope that won't happen while you're rebuilding.
So having worked for storage companies in the past, I'm surprised, but not surprised, that they were not able to handle a double disk failure. It is a little crazy that they built a system like that and was like, this is good enough.
Yeah. Let's get to that in a minute. I want to ask you a really big question, Persona.
Huh.
How did we find out about this?
Oh, so it was published in some articles right after the fact, but the only reason that this was even picked up by the news was because Carbonite decided to sue the vendors for breach of contract and breach of warranty. And
both the IT vendor and the storage vendor.
Yep. In order to recoup some of the costs. And that's where all this information came out as they were seeking damages.
Yeah. And I remember being, like backup guy at the time. And I mean, this is 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember to the day, it's 15 years ago. And what's interesting was timing wise, 15 years ago, I had my first Mac that had Thunderbolt.
Mm.
Okay. Why does that figure into the story? Here's why. At the time, I was running a company and I needed a decent sized storage array for my, by the way, the computer I'm talking about is literally right over there. It's literally sitting over there.
iMac?
The new iMacs, yeah. Right? And it had Thunderbolt, and we were doing video editing on it, and we needed a nice sized array to buy it. And the only arrays that you could buy at the time that were Thunderbolt were Promise arrays.
Yep.
And when you cert at the time, the Promise arrays, they were great. I had it. I actually still have the Promise array somewhere. But the thing was that they were also known for being the cheapest arrays that you could buy at the time. Yeah. So when this story broke, I realized a bunch of things. I'm like, wait, this big cloud backup company is using the cheapest storage arrays that, and they're just using like regular old storage arrays, not like good ones. They're not, you know, they're supposed to be the cloud. They're supposed to be using advanced technology So there was that. The other thought I had was, wait, they just have like one comp. They just have one copy of each customer's data, and it's not even using RAID DP.
Yes.
It's not using mirroring. It's not using RAID DP. So all it takes is one double disk failure,
and you're done.
And then the other thing was, I said to myself, why, if this was me, first off, I don't think I would have made that decision. I think I would have done something very differently. Second, if I had made that decision, I'm going to publicly announce to the world that I made that decision. And like, what was going through anybody's mind?
It seems like a big PR snafu.
Big PR snafu, a bad business decision to buy the arrays in the first place. I'm not saying that Promise arrays are bad. I will say that having that much data without having RAID DP, bad.
Yeah.
Right? That much data without having mirroring or something like that, that where a double disk failure just takes your data out. Double disk failures happen all the time. You used to work at a company that did this.
That's why. So there is a quote, and I don't know if and I will cover it now. The CEO David Friend
at the time. He's no longer the CEO. He was
So he had explained sort of, okay, this is why they had crashed, because we were using Promise technology and we're using RAID and we suffered a single disk failure. So he said that we switched to a popular Dell server that uses RAID 6 that allows the loss of 3 of the 15 drives simultaneously before you lose any data. The configuration is, in theory, 36 million times more reliable than a single disk drive. The chances of 3 out of 15 drives failing at the same time are almost nil. Now, having worked at multiple storage companies, I want to call BS on that nearly nil. Yeah. Right?
On the 3 drives failing at the same time?
Yeah. Having worked at companies, especially given the size of disks these days, what I've experienced is that during the times when you're actually doing a RAID rebuild, that's actually when you're putting additional stress on all the other disks as you're doing a whole bunch of reads, recomputing parity in order to write out and recover the new disk. That's actually the time in which those other disks, if there's any weakness in them, that's when they fail.
I feel a story coming on, Persona.
What's the story?
The story is my Oracle. This is the first time. So I left. I was no longer like an IT, regular IT practitioner. I was now a consultant. And I was at this major oil and gas company. And I was just supposed to be the admin. I wasn't supposed to be the backup guy. But I went around and I was seeing that the backups were just broken. And one of the servers that really bothered me was it was a Solaris. I remember it was running Solaris 2.3, which at the time was a seriously buggy version of Solaris. And I was trying to get the first ever backup of this Oracle database, which was a 300 gigabyte Yep. 300 gigabyte
massive Oracle Curtis, database. Massive.
Massive. Huge, right? And it was what was called a DSS, decision support system. It was all the rage back in the day. And it was the kind of thing that took imports nightly from the mainframe. And it had never been backed up, ever. And I had to argue with the DBA that he didn't want me to do it. He didn't want me turning on archive log mode, because archive log mode corrupted Oracle databases. Oh, that was his
stance
belief.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is that the stance of Oracle, or is that just some random thing that's in your head? And it was the latter. And he said, well, if it doesn't corrupt it, it causes performance lower, you know, it lowers the performance. And I was like, well, look, we've got to get this thing backed up at least once. And so either I shut down the database and back it up one night, or which they didn't want to do because that's when they did the nightly yeah. uploads, or I need to put it in archive log mode at least for a couple of days so I can do a hot backup of it.
Yep.
And then I went to go, I went, and that's when I looked at it and I saw that not only was it Solaris 2.3, but it was Solaris 2.3 completely unpatched.
Oh, geez. Right?
It had been like a couple of years.
Nobody wanted to touch it.
Patches.
Right? Yeah.
And so I knew, because I had already encountered it at this client, that if I put the backup software that I was using, the features of Solaris that it used during a backup would cause it to crash if I kicked it off. I knew I had to put on the latest jumbo patch of Solaris in order to do the backup. And so I did. And I got it rebooted. And this was like a Friday afternoon. And I got my first ever backup of this 300 gigabyte database. And then over the weekend, 5 drives failed. Right?
Should never have rebooted the server, Curtis.
Yeah. So I came in Monday morning, and basically the drives failed. And by the way, it was the only, an additional wrinkle was this was a place who didn't buy Sun servers from Sun. They bought like pieces and parts. Yeah.
And put it together themselves. And then.
Yeah. But this server was from Sun. And so I was able to call Sun, get Sun in over the weekend, replace the drives, you know, rebuild the file system, restore the database, and it was up and running come Monday morning. And I was cock of the walk, baby. Right. And then this DBA comes up to me and he sees me and he's like, I bet you think you're hot shit, don't you? And I'm like, yeah, I kind of do. You know, I'm feeling pretty good about myself right now. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, you don't get any credit. I was like, why is that? He goes, I'm not exactly sure what killed the server or those disk drives, but I think it was your fault. And he's like, I have a couple of theories. One is you did this backup and it exercised the disk drives more than they were used to being used. And so that's what caused the thing to fail. Or it was the fact that Oracle was in archive log mode and that's maybe what caused it. Or the fact that you put in that big jumbo patch.
Yeah.
And one of those things killed the disk drives. And so since you killed the disk drives, you get no credit for saving us. I was like, okay, whatever, dude. So, yes, boy. Multiple disk drives. In this case, 5 disk drives can fail all at once. This is why we back up. This is why we do mirroring. This is why we do all kinds of I guess it just really disappointed me at the time. And so it was really surprising that a company who this is what they do, they were just using the same RAID arrays, you know, that I'm putting on the back of the back of my iMac. I was very disappointed. I spoke a lot there, but
no,
it just bugged me when it happened. What do you think?
No, I agree with you. And the challenge is their marketing messages and everything else at the time, right, portrayed it as a high quality backup solution for customers so they don't need to worry about backup and everything else that comes along with it, right? They're like, yeah, we will deal with everything for you. And when customers put their trust and their faith in that, the company didn't quite meet the bar.
Yeah. And I guess it's just, even to this day, in the subsequent articles that came out after the original article, when the CEO, David Friend, was going to the people say, hey, you know, I just want to correct the you know,
it's not 7,500. Yeah.
It wasn't 7,500 customers that lost data. It was 54 customers lost data because only 54 customers couldn't restore. Right. But still in those further comments, he was still like blaming Promise.
Yeah.
Like he even, you know, and by the way, I do want to say I was able to find the docket, the actual filing, and the lawsuit was settled out of court. Right. Okay. So there's no public record of what the actual thing is. But I highly doubt that, you know, they're a storage array vendor. Disk drives fail. And sometimes monitoring stuff fails. And, you know, I could not for the life of me fathom the idea of suing your storage array vendor. It's a little bit like when Musi sued Google because they deleted their own data.
Yeah.
Right. I just don't understand that. So there was an article from Backblaze, which for the record is a competitor to Carbonite, but I still agree with their point. And they were saying that they felt that the coverage of this incident missed one of the crucial points of this story. And that is that a backup vendor outsourced the backup. And they made they made a point of saying that it's like Google outsourcing search, right? And I have to agree with them, right? They weren't saying they were reselling backup. They were saying they were a backup vendor, and you would think that they would deal with that, right? At the time, the response to that was that the CEO said that they now write their own software, right? So I don't know.
Yeah.
In that blog, it says building robust online backup technology is difficult. There are certainly lots of complexities involved to ensure data is backed up, redundant, and secure. It is the role of the online backup service provider to have the technical expertise and laser focus to work through these items. Pushing it off to an outside company seems a bit risky.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that we started with this, right, as the 3-2-1 rule. They were not doing the 3-2-1 rule at all, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, there are probably a bunch of vendors out there that, for example, are relying on, you know, backup vendors that are storing only one copy on S3, right? Now, S3 stores three copies, but you still are relying. But in that case, you're relying on what arguably is like the most tested storage array service in the world, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But as opposed to Promise, which was a little known product that I'm willing to bet the reason they bought them is they were the least expensive. That's probably why I bought them.
Yeah.
That and the fact that they did Thunderbolt at the time. It was really hard to get Thunderbolt-based storage arrays back then.
I think at the time it was probably OWC and Promise.
Yeah, yeah. And OWC was probably more expensive, so I didn't buy it. So what happened after that story, Prasanna, which I didn't even know about until we were researching this story, until you brought it up?
Yeah, so apparently I came across while looking for lawsuits against Carbonite. It looks like they just settled one in January 31st of 2024, so a couple of months ago from this recording, for $27.5 million. Apparently, so Carbonite was acquired in 2019 by a Canadian company called OpenText.
So and 5 years ago, they were acquired.
Yep.
Yeah.
But before they were acquired, Carbonite apparently had made some statements that misled investors. And they were releasing a new backup solution called Server VM Edition that they promised was super strong and extremely competitive, that launched in 2018, October. And the company said the product would allow businesses to recover virtual machines data from a single location. And then they got sued by investors because they said the product never worked and that it never once successfully backed up a customer's data and that the executives basically knew it did not work and still made those statements. And so this was just settled for $27.5 million to resolve the claims.
Yeah, it's interesting. So they accused the company of violating the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 after this news came out and the stock price fell more than 24% the next day. The judge initially dismissed the case, but the Court of Appeals reversed them in 2021 and certified the class as a class action. And then it looks like they finally settled it and agreed to pay $27 million. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Wonder how many promissories I don't buy. Sorry, that was just mean. What I used to say about carbonite was, you know, just Google, like when you're looking at vendors, just Google their name and lawsuit, because at the time, carbonite was the only one that would come up with results. What's interesting here, like, it's sort of like with OVH. Why in the world would anyone use a vendor? Why would they go public? Why would somebody invest? And it's because these stories, they just go under the radar. I think an IaaS vendor like OVH, who showed that they don't know how to build data centers.
They went IPO.
They didn't do fire suppression. They didn't do, why would you ever want to do business with them? And I have a similar feeling. This is just my feeling, my opinion. If a company is, so two incidents of clear misjudgment, one in terms of the original design and outsourcing to another vendor. And then the second, the decision to make this public by blaming the vendor. Yeah. What that says to me is you take no blame yourself.
Yeah.
If they had done a mea culpa, if they had said, hey, we really screwed up, we shouldn't have trusted everything to this vendor, maybe even trashed him, I don't care. Yeah. Right. Now that I think back on it, that's the part that bothered me the most in the story.
And your point
is that to this day, they take no responsibility for that. Yeah. They know there's no wrongdoing. They admit no wrongdoing in the SEC, the settlement.
Yeah. Yep.
At least they're consistent.
So, yeah. So I think, like you said, this is useful because I don't think people actually do this. So when you're searching for a vendor, we always talk about go read reviews, go talk to other people, look at analyst results or analyst opinions and things like that. Look at like the IDC surveys and the Magic Quadrant from Gartner. I don't think that we've told people go Google the vendor plus lawsuit. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Go look and see what has come up. Like, is this a company that you are comfortable doing business with and trusting that they will stand beside you when things go wrong, if things go wrong?
Yeah, and I think it's important to say that I have no axe to grind with these folks, right? I don't work for a competitor. They didn't personally wrong me. They've never discussed me publicly that I know of. It chaps my hide. It just the idea that you accepted no responsibility for that. And then again, apparently, even up to recently, it appears that you were doing stuff that seems a little shady.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, granted, that was 2018 when they made those statements, but
that's not that long ago, man.
I know.
That was just before COVID. Yes, COVID's like a day.
Yeah.
When COVID, the entire period of COVID counts as like a day. That was 2019.
Yeah. Now, the one thing, though, that we have to state is since the acquisition by OpenText, things could be different, right?
That is true.
So I think we should at least give them that benefit of the doubt that things could be
different. That's actually a really good point. Thanks for bringing that up. You know, we're commenting mainly about the company that was Carbonite before it was acquired by OpenText. And perhaps this acquisition of OpenText will significantly change things, or has already significantly changed things. this is really what we need to, when I think about like the OVH situation, what can we learn from this? What can people do to protect themselves from this when using a cloud backup vendor? I would number one, be asking them what kind of storage technology they're using, right?
I would ask where do about you store the availability data? And redundancy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
You know, are you using storage arrays or are you using S3? Or are you using, you know, how are you storing my data and how are you making sure, you know, that it stays available?
Yeah. I think though, as a user, maybe what underlying technology is less important, because I could see some vendors maybe would not discuss that, but at least ensuring the characteristics that you expect of S3. So for instance, is it geographically spread out, right? Is it redundant? Is it a replicated copy, independent copy, right? Those sort of things.
I understand what you're saying. They might not want to say, but like, you know, where we used to work, we just say, it's on S3, right? If you can say that, I think that gives you a certain amount of
confidence,
right?
Yeah.
Just like you just said, is this designed to survive, you know, a fire like what happened at OVH? Is this designed to survive, you know, a multiple disk failure? What happens in a catastrophic failure of, you know, because let's just say this. Because here's the thing. A single fire would have done the same thing.
Yep.
It doesn't have to be. Who are they going to sue then? Their fire extinguisher company? Right? What the core problem here is that they had a single copy of customer data.
Yep.
And that's it.
Yep.
Right? No redundancy. No geo-redundancy. No
or even if they had a derecho go through. Redundancy.
A derecho. You love talking about that derecho, don't you?
I love talking about the derecho. It's an awesome
word. I never heard of a derecho until we talked about it on the show.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a hurricane that starts over land, for those of you that don't know what a derecho is. And don't ask me why. It's the same as the word, or really close to the word for right in Spanish. Can you think of any other, you know, things that a customer can do to... Because you know what this reminds me of? You know, there's, you know, you remember the old thing of like on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog, right? Yeah. Like, it's like, what can a customer do to ensure that they don't go to essentially another vendor that behaves the way Carbonite did back in 2009?
I think another thing you should do, and it's not a guarantee, but at least gives you some protections, is take a look in their SLAs and in the contract. Right? Do they talk about disaster recovery, redundancy? Do they talk about SLAs? Do they talk anything about geographic separation for storage?
Right.
Right. If it's there, that's good. If it's missing, ask the questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not
ask as many questions as you can.
It's not foolproof.
Nothing's foolproof.
Like we found with OVH, right? It was written in the contracts, but it still didn't mean anything. But at least it gives you more legal standing for if there is a lawsuit that comes from this.
Yeah. I hope the audience has appreciated this. This is our best attempt to deduce. I'm looking up here at my browser and there are like 17 tabs open to the story, to the different stories, all of which we're trying to cover the same article. And one of the reasons for that is that the original article is gone. The original article in the Boston Globe, is it? That original article is gone. And I also couldn't find it in the Internet Archive. I tried doing that. So we had to look at a whole bunch of different blogs that were essentially trying to summarize the same article. But, you know, this is our best attempt at trying to see what we saw from all these various articles.
And it may not be 100% accurate, right? We're just going off the information
based on the articles that we have. Yeah. All right. Well, it's been not fun. This is not a fun one. I don't like it. This is my world. And this is people that lost data.
It's not what
we told them to do and they still lost data.
So it's not fun, but I think it's hopefully eye-opening for folks that they need to be more inquisitive and not just blindly trust vendors.
Yeah. Never blindly trust vendors.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Prasanna, for your usual analysis.
I enjoy these. I actually like this series, Curtis. I hope our listeners do as well.
Yeah, I'm enjoying the series as well. It's been nice to go back to these stories that I remember from 15 years ago. And then we're, in some cases, like the OVH fire, we're seeing some follow-up. In this one, we saw some follow-up we didn't expect from quite a bit later, which is technically unrelated, but, anyway. Listeners, we appreciate you. We'd be nothing without you. And be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss an episode. That is a wrap.